Right.
One, two, three, four. One, two, three, four.
That's beautiful. It's fine. Where I think we're all set. We just. And let me begin then by indicating that today is March 14th, 1995, and this is Jim Boning speaking with Bob Rowland at the CMA offices in Washington. Mr. Rowland, I know you were born in Philadelphia, but I don't know when.
January. No, I was born January 14, 1931. Which makes me 64 years young.
And in Philadelphia?
In Philadelphia.
Tell me something about your parents and your family background.
My mother and father were both Philadelphians. My father was a businessman who was an entrepreneur. I was born, as you can tell, in the Depression. And I have one sibling, an older brother who is a year and a half older than I am, who is John Harry Rowland Jr. And we were born in Philadelphia, in West Philadelphia. My mother's maiden name was McNichol. And her father ran a clothing store, in fact had a chain of clothing stores in Philadelphia called Perryman. And so my father was an entrepreneur. He owned a hardware store. He owned an automobile dealership. He owned a number of apartment houses. And he was a major shareholder in a local bank. And when the Depression hit, as you well know, everything went south. But it was particularly unfortunate for people who had bank shares or were in the ownership or management of banks, because they had to pay back the value of their shares. And my father walked into the bank on the day that the president declared a bank holiday and made a deposit. An hour later, that deposit was gone too. So they were bankrupt, needless to say. At that particular time, they had just purchased a house in suburban Philadelphia, out in the western suburbs called Upper Darby, Highland Park. And I was just born at that time. And so my father went to work as a salesman. And he got into, at that time you sold anything you could get your hands on, and thereafter you sold everything. He worked for a very large wholesale distributor's business in Philadelphia called Pierce Phelps. And they're still in business. And he became general sales manager of that company. And there were some really hard times. Hard times in that I remember during the war he would sell dolls. He would sell some kinky kind of, you know, your things you see advertised on TV now. He had been in World War I, so he wasn't called back into World War II. There were some interesting things, though, because he sold some first TV sets. And we always had TV sets and good radios, and the product line, both for refrigerators, white goods, and hard goods, that Pierce Phelps handled was Crosley. And Powell Crosley, who owned the Cincinnati Reds, was quite an entrepreneur and character, and also created the small little automobile. Well, I got to see those little automobiles and drive one of those, went, drove around in one with my father. So that his life was interesting, and he made it interesting for me, maybe by virtue of circumstances. We're Catholic, Roman Catholic, and so whenever there was a school holiday, and the Catholics had school holidays that others didn't get, I would be sent home. My mother didn't work. She stayed home and looked after the boys, and his mother lived with us, my grandmother, maternal grandmother. My mother's mother and father were alive, too, for many years, so there was a good-sized family involved. But when we'd get a holiday, my father would put us in the car, or if not both of us, at least one of us if we wanted to go, and I always wanted to go. And he would take us on his calls to the various dealers. Okay. The net result was that these were small little dealers, mom and pop stores. And most of them had their living quarters upstairs. If they didn't, at the very least, they had some kind of an apartment or kitchen arrangement in the back of the store or in the basement of the store. And if you went to South Philadelphia, it was Italian. If you went to North Philadelphia, it was Jewish. If you went to another neighborhood six blocks over, it was Polish. If you went to another one over here, it was Irish. My father carried a yarmulke in the glove compartment of his car because there were a lot of Orthodox stores that he went to. And he never knew when he was going to be invited to go to a bar mitzvah or something else. And so I got to meet all of these interesting people. And to see selling, not just firsthand, communicating firsthand, but under very difficult circumstances. Because these were people who, you know, they would order a couple of refrigerators, a couple of televisions, a couple of radios, a couple of this, washing machines or something. And then they had to make a quota, and then they would sell against that quota, and then there were all these trips that they'd get to go on. And so I got to see that when I was a kid. And I not only enjoyed meeting all the people and moving around town, but I got to appreciate all of the different, you know, kinds and colors that existed in the city of Philadelphia, which was a delight to me because I had been taken out of the city and transferred to the suburbs, where I saw only one flavor, you know, when I was growing up, by and large, because right. I went to parochial school. So that was interesting. And
was your education then in Upper Darby, not in West Philly?
No, my education was in Philadelphia. I went to grade school at St. Lawrence, which was a parochial school in Upper Darby, in okay. Highland Park. And they were Immaculate Heart nuns that taught there. And, you know, it was your typical neighborhood kind of thing. The school was built contiguous to the church. You know, that you were paraded into the church for the Stations of the Cross on Friday and the other religious ceremonies during the year. The parish house was right across the street. The public school was right next door to the Catholic school. So the public school kids and the Catholic school kids, you know, yelled over the fence and played and fought and threw rocks and all that stuff. The Diocese of Philadelphia was the diocese that we belonged to, and there were no Catholic parochial school high schools until long after I left. In fact, one of the kids I went to school with became the first pastor of the first parochial high school, Bonner, I think it was, which used to be St. Vincent's Home out in Upper Darby. And Dave Duffy, who was one of my neighbors and classmates and buddies, he went out and ran that school. We went in town to school. Went in town to West Philadelphia, and I went to West Catholic High School. And there was transportation right from where I lived. It was a trolley line, high-speed trolley line, Red Arrow.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
And the Red Arrow went to 69th Street, which was the main terminus, the end of Philadelphia and the beginning of Upper Darby, the township. And then from there you would take the L in town. Well, nobody did that. We went out and stood on the corner of Westchester Pike, which was the main access from further west down into 69th Street and down into town. There were people who drove by every day for their way to business. We all stood out on the corner and hitchhiked into class. And there was a last trolley that you knew you could get, and there was a last hop that you knew you could get. And you knew who those people were, and you knew the times. And there was a pecking order of seniority. And no matter when you came to the corner, if you were a freshman, you were at the bottom of the line. If you were a senior, you went to the top of the line. So you just hoped that none of the seniors showed up while you were waiting to get there. Because it was, you know, a very anxious thing. I would say that I could count on one hand the number of times that I either missed or was late for class in the 4 years that I went to high school. And that was amazing. Later on, when you got in the senior year, there were some kids that ended up getting cars or having access to their parents' cars, and you'd drive in with them. But that was a very casual, very easygoing thing. Today, I don't think you would see that kind of thing happening. But So I went to West
Philly. West Philly's changed, too, since.
Oh, enormously. and only four blocks over, I guess it was, or three or four, from West Catholic was West Philadelphia High School. And there was enormous competition, you know, between those two. But West Catholic was big time. It was big time sports. It was a big time school. Christian Brothers ran it. When we won a football game, we were at 49th and Chestnut, and we'd go out to 54th or 56th Street and let the band off and let the team off and let everybody go. We'd march down the damn street, close off Chestnut Street, you know, or Walnut Street, and all the band and everybody come out on their porch, and that's the way it was. When you had a city high school championship game that was at Scheid Park at that time, I mean, you'd get 10,000-12,000 people to go out and see it, and some of the big ones, 30,000 people would show up to a football game. So it was a very exciting time, and it was a big school again, but a decent education. Decent education.
Were you involved in athletics?
Yes, I spent a good deal of my time rowing. I loved crew. My uncles were both oarsmen, and my oldest uncle, Babe, he rowed for the Penn AC, and I rowed for Penn AC. And he also rowed in the Great Eight of 1928, which was an eight that went around the world and beat everybody. They were world champions from everywhere. And he rowed with Jack Kelly and Charlie McIlvain and people like that from Philadelphia. And then when I rowed, Jack Jr. was a big star. He was older than I was. But I spent a lot of time down on Boathouse Row, and that was a delight also. That was a good education. I played sporadically at basketball and football and other things, and I liked ice hockey as well. But I would say crew was my favorite sport. I spent about 6, 7, or 8 years rowing, both in high school and in club rowing after that.
Philadelphia must be unusual in that there are so many high school teams. You don't find that too many other places.
There was a huge league, you know, both public and Catholic league, and the competition citywide was very keen and very spirited. I mean, there were a few brawls even back then, but North Catholic High School, I think, was the largest Catholic high school in the country. They had like 3,000 kids or 2,000 kids. It was enormous.
Wow.
Huge, huge plants.
You said your academic preparation was good. Was it rigorous as it might have been in a Catholic school at that time?
Yeah, it was. And I liked school. I always liked reading, and I studying didn't bother me, and I always got good marks. It was just something that came relatively easy to me, and I always enjoyed it. I was always disciplined enough that I realized my brother was the opposite. My brother was a musician and had no interest in scholastics and what have you, and of course he was talented. That was his talent. He could play the piano and he could write music and he could do all that, and he was very clever, so that was a whole different thing. My just inclination was, when it was Friday afternoon and you got off school and you had the whole weekend ahead of you, I did my homework Friday afternoon, Friday night. I didn't have to worry about it from then on. You know, no matter how tempted I was to do something else, I always said, I know I won't do it Sunday night. I don't want to do it Sunday night. The likelihood of my even getting it half right is better if I do it Friday when I'm leaving school than Sunday when I'm going to go back. So that was the kind of attitude I had about, you know, my life, my responsibilities, and school. So I did well. My father was not a college graduate. My mother was not a college graduate either. My mother had gone to girls' school for a while. But they encouraged me, always encouraged me. I did most of the academic stuff on my own or with the teachers that I had. I had good teachers. And West Catholic was a big boys' school. And you had dummies. I went to school with some boys who, by the time we got to our sophomore year, we found out they really couldn't read. And we had those cases. And we had cases of people who couldn't add, who got a bad grade school education for one reason or another, and faked their way through or were passed through. But if you didn't get an education from the Christian Brothers, it was your fault. If you didn't get an education from the nuns, it was your fault. I mean, it was there. And all the help that you ever needed was there, because that's all they did. That's their full-time job. So if you went after class and said, you know, brother, I don't understand what this trigonometry thing is, or I don't understand fractions. And I was always lousy in math. That was my weakest subject. I mean, they'd give you all the time in the world. They'd take you over to the house. They'd put you in a room, and they'd give you assignments, and they'd come back and mark you and work with you. So it was your fault, not theirs, if you didn't get educated. And when I got out of high school, I had a crew scholarship offered to me from Columbia. But I wanted to go to Villanova. I had no great desire to go to New York or to leave town or leave the state. I just enjoyed some of the things. And I liked rowing on the club, and I thought, what the hell, I don't need the scholarship. I can work my way through school and do some other things. And so I decided to stay home and went to Villanova and enjoyed Villanova immensely. Good school, much smaller then. It was a college, not a university when I went there. And they didn't have a law school or a med school or a nursing school or any of those things. But I enjoyed it immensely. And when I went there, I took business. That was my inclination. The first 2 years of college were always what you'd call toleration courses anyway. You all got the same crap. It was only after your second year that you picked a major that you were going to focus on. And I picked economics and pre-law, and that's what I did. And I enjoyed college. It was relatively easy. For the last 2 years of college, it wasn't known by many people, but I spent a lot of time marking papers and assisting the professors in the class on constitutional law and economics and some of the other courses. But they had bigger classes then, and the teacher said, I can't grade all these papers and do this, I'll need some help. So they would pick somebody from the class that they thought was good enough that they wouldn't blow the test themselves, but wouldn't, you know, tell anybody what they were doing. And I took all the guys' tests home, and one guy got wise to me, who was the guy that we took turns driving back and forth. And it was only toward the nice fella, and he was very straightforward about it. He said, you know, it's interesting. I noticed that the only time you carry a big briefcase is after a test. How come that is? He said, are you marking these papers? I said, even if I was, I wouldn't tell you, and you know that. He said, okay, that's interesting.
Let me just back up a moment to high school. Was there anyone who had any particular influence on you during your high school career? You've mentioned your uncles and the rowing and that particular influence.
Not really that jumps out at me. Okay. I mean, I just had a good time. The coaches, you know, the people that I rode with and hung out with, the teachers at school, I mean, they were just all neat people. There were a lot of characters and a lot of color and a lot of excitement. It was just a good time to be alive, in my opinion, and a thrilling time, because there were always new things. You know, some of the questions you would ask about changes and future, and I just can't imagine having been born and lived at a more exciting time than I have. I characterize that by a fellow that worked with me, who has since passed on, but he worked with me over at Paint and Coatings, and his name was Francis Schofield. Francis was a genius. He had a photographic memory. He was well educated. He went to Lehigh and some other places, and Dr. Shorty Long, who was one of the great teachers and innovators in the chemical industry and the coatings industry, polymers and things, said that Francis would have been a millionaire if he wasn't so damn lazy. Somebody had to get up and kick him in the ass every morning to get him started. And that was true. I mean, he'd rather have a drink than, you know, work. But he was a brilliant guy. Francis, when I came down here in 1958, end of 58, Francis Schofield's father worked in the Department of Agriculture. And Francis recounted for me, when he was a small boy, his father taking him across Memorial Bridge to where Arlington Cemetery is now, which was called Meadows over there. to watch a demonstration by the Wright brothers of their new airplane. And they had hoped that this would have some value to government, and one of the big departments of government, the only big department of government then, was agriculture. And they hoped to get some money from agriculture to develop this for crop dusting, or I don't know what they'll have in mind. But Francis also saw the men land and walk on the moon. In that man's lifetime, his living, functioning, sentient, totally aware lifetime went from the Wright brothers to the landing of the moon. Now think about that in that period of years. The history of aviation is like a 50-year period, 60-year period. And I used to hear the statement that 90% of the scientists who have ever lived in the history of the world are alive today. That's not because of a lot of old scientists. It's because the realm of science as we know it is a relatively short period. Yeah, we stand on the shoulders of the Newtons and a lot of other people back here, but this tremendous leapfrogging that has taken place in 50, 60 years, and the impact of World War II, for example, and World War I on accelerating just the industry that we're in, those things always impressed me and excited me. Okay? Now, back to the question. I would say that the first person, there are loads of people that I knew, nuns and priests and Christian brothers and buddies and, you know, parents of my friends, and our parents always took us with them. I mean, when we grew up in the Depression, you know, the idea of my father coming home on a Saturday and saying, I'm not working today, we're going to clean out the garage, or we're going to do this, or we're going to do that. And he was a great handyman, okay? And when the hardware store went bankrupt, half the stock of the hardware store was in the basement of the house, so he had every tool known to man available to him. And when we were finished, you know, at noontime, you know, my mother went out and went up to the little shopping area where we lived. Well, there was a butcher shop, and there was a grocery store, and there was a drug store, and there was, you know, all these little specialty stores, and there was a dry cleaner, and there was a gas station, and there was a bar and everything. Well, the biggest thing for me was when my father would say, well, no lunch here at home, we're going to go up to Busty's Cafe and get a hamburger. He'd have a beer and a hamburger, and I'd get a sip of the beer, and I'd have a hamburger in the bar with all the neighborhood guys and everything. And it was not that it was so attractive to be drinking, but you were just there in a social center and watching all these, you know, larger-than-life characters and what went on. I didn't find it, as some people say, well, you know, that leads you down the road to hanging out in bars. I found it more an experience of life as to how to deal with these things. And my father always took me wherever he would go, wherever I wanted to go. And so I understood these things, they were experiences, and I enjoyed them. I will say that all the way up until law school, and, you know, the first time I really sweated, you know, was I going to be good enough and am I good enough, was in law school. I mean, I went to the University of Pennsylvania, and I got accepted on my own and graduated on my own and made the bar the first time out. So that was hard work. But again, I did well, did very well, and wrote the gouge for a number of, joined a law club, and I did the gouge on two or three subjects down there, which meant I wrote the notes that the club sold to other people to study for their exams from, and I learned some lessons from that. But that was the first experience where I would say I met a most unforgettable character, and that was Dean Jefferson B. Fordham, who was the dean of the law school then. Jeff Fordham came from Michigan, and he also had been down in North Carolina. He was a Carolinian. He was a consummate Southern gentleman, a handsome man, a handsome fellow, bright as can be. And he elevated, to my way of thinking, you know, the law school and the whole environment there by his style and by his brilliance. He had worked in the SEC under the Truman administration, and he knew Washington. When I was in my first year of law school. The most important thing that can happen to you in your law school career is being chosen to work on the Law Review. The top people from the first year class compete for this on grades and other things. And at the end of my first year of law school, I contracted hepatitis. And I was quite ill and missed a month of school. And when I got well, I went back and went in to see Dean Fordham. And he said, "Bob," he said, "do you think you're going to be able to make it?" And I said, "Yeah, I'm sure I can." And he said, "You know, you've missed an awful lot." And I said, "Well, to the degree I can, I've studied and read and what have you." And I was just sick as a dog. I mean, I don't know if you ever had it, but I couldn't stand to eat, I couldn't stand to smell, I couldn't stand to read. I just laid there for the better part of 3 weeks, 4 weeks, until I was able to get up. And he said, "Well, I'll tell you what." He said, I'll let you take the exams, and we'll see how that works out. And he said, "If you think there's a problem," he said, "don't feel badly about it. We can always go back and start you over and do this." And I said, "Okay." So I took the exams and I passed everything. And I missed Law Review. Just missed Law Review. And that bothered me no end. But there was nothing I could do about it. He called me into his office right after the exams were posted. And he said, "You did really well." And he said, "I'm pleased, and you ought to be pleased with how well you did." And I said, "Well, thank you." I said, "I appreciate the support you gave me and everything else." He said, "What are you going to do this summer?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to get married this summer and blah, 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 and all that." And that was my intent, but I didn't. And he said, "Well, would you like to work for me?" And I said, "Geez, I'd love to." He said, "Okay." He said, "Here's how much I'll pay you, and you get a desk in the law library where the Law Review people sit." So all the guys that were my best friends who were now Law Review, I was still a peer of theirs. And another fellow, Charlie Buffalino, who was from the Buffalino crime family in upper Pennsylvania, upstate, Charlie was also selected to work with Jeff Fordham. And he was a very bright guy. Charlie was very bright. So me to he was chairman of something called the American Bar Association Municipal Law Section, and the Municipal Law Section dealt with largely funding and instruments for funding, bonds and other instruments that municipalities and states and what have you would issue to fund their activities. To digress for one moment, he asked me to edit the Municipal Law Service letter. And he said, "This is a publication that goes out to the American Bar Association members who belong to this section." And he said, "We review cases and do this and do that." He said, "I want you to put all that together and publish this newsletter and what have you." He said, "At the same time," he said, "I want you to do some research for me, because I'm writing a case book on municipal law, and I want you to help me with the editing and the work on that." And then he said, "I'm also going to do one on constitutional law, and I want you to help me with that if you possibly could." And then we did one on regulatory law as well, municipal law and regulatory law. So during the next 2 years, two summers, and during the year, I worked for him. And he brought me to Washington and introduced me to the people at what that time was in the Bureau of the Budget, which was the Legislative Reference Service. So we were working on a legislative book, and this was how laws were made and everything else. Okay. We did reviews on constitutional law. He gave me a problem. He said, you know, here is a case that we have, I want you to research and see what you can get me of any other case law. I worked one whole summer practically on that thing. It's just, you know, riveting. I found nothing. So when you find nothing in the case law in the United States, you look at comparative law. So I went off to England and I looked at the continent and I ended up in Australia, and the Australian legislature legal system is similar to the United States. They also have a balance of powers structure down there in the Supreme Court. And eventually I found a case in the Supreme Court of Australia that I thought was on point for this, and I was extremely pleased. So I went in to see him at the end of the summer, and I was turning over, now here's what I've done on this, and, you know, you've gotten all my reports and these are the chapters for that. And, oh, by the way, on this particular problem here, I have found a case. I said, it's not in the United States. He says, oh, is it that Australian case? Well, you know, to me, that was not a put-down. You know, to me, that just said, you know, this guy is so smart, and he wanted, he said, don't feel badly. He said, I didn't know that was all that was left. And he said, now I'm pretty sure that it is. You've made it clear to me that that's it. And I learned from that, you know, that there are different reasons why people do things, and research requires proof and vetting and checking and peer review and all that. So that was, I will say that working with, working for Jeff Fordham, being allowed to accompany him to a lot of places, tried to make me a Democrat. He couldn't do that. But he was a wonderful man, and treated me, despite the fact that his experiences and everything were so far beyond where I was at that stage of my life, but to treat me, you know, as a peer, to treat me as a colleague, which he did, was a huge step in my maturation. And so when you look back on people who impressed you or helped you, I would say that experience, personal experience, was enormous. The personal experiences with my father, you know, during the very difficult times of the Depression, that was important. I would say that when I got out of law school, I was married by the time I got out and had my first child. And in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, you have a preceptor. And there was a law firm in Delaware County in Upper Darby that was my preceptor, and I did some work for them too. But by the time I got out of law school, the Korean War was well on, and I had this feeling. Now, I had been in the ROTC when I was in college. Before I left college, I quit the ROTC. And I quit because I said, you know, there's nothing going on here, and I want to go to law school, so I'm not going to worry about the draft. If I get drafted, okay, but nothing's happening. So I got all the way through law school and everything. And when I got out, I said, you know, I just feel that I have an obligation, and I'm just concerned that people still get drafted. And even though I have a child and all of this, I enlisted. I enlisted in the Navy. And I said, I want to get this behind me. That's just how I feel about it. So I enlisted and was finally accepted, and I was going off to boot camp, and I was going to boot camp at went to boot camp at the Newport, Rhode Island. And when I got out of boot camp, they said, are you aware of the fact, you know, that you can be an officer so easy? It's just stupid for you to be an enlisted man. It just doesn't make any sense at all. You've got a law degree and you've got all this. And I said, well, whatever you think. And they said, well, just keep on going through this officer's class then. So I got out of Newport and I got a commission. And I went in the Navy, and I spent 3.5 years in the Navy. And because, interestingly enough, funny how things turn in your life, because I wore glasses, I could not get a line designator. Line officers are the ones that had the stars. The Supply Corps officers had Oakleys. Medical officers had a different pyracantha leaf. So even though I was an officer, I couldn't be a line officer. So I had to go to Supply Corps school. If you went to Supply Corps school and did well, then you would immediately be sent to sea. So you'd get 1 year at sea, and then you'd be transferred back to land. If you didn't do well, then you wouldn't get independent duty right away. You'd be sent to a base somewhere, and then you'd spend the rest of your 3 years at sea somewhere. So I went to Georgia, and I got out of Supply Corps school, and I did well, and I was assigned to a destroyer, and I spent the better part of a year and a half on the destroyer. And we were headed for the Med, for the Suez thing, and I came down with something. What the hell was it? Oh. I had an ear infection and ended up with motion sickness, severe motion sickness. And the doctor on the boat, the ship with us, Marvis Marsteller, said, you can't go to bed. He said, you've been on this ship now for the better part of a year. Every time we go out, you get sick as a bitch. I said, well, you know, as a kid, I was on boats all the time. He said, makes no difference. He said, it's relative movement, not, you know. He said, do you get car sick? I said, no, I've never been sick in a car in my life. He said, that's relative. You don't see any moving. He said, you got a problem here. So the ship went to the Suez, and I went to the Charleston, South Carolina Naval Hospital. I got out of the hospital. They gave me all these tests, and they said, you're never going to see again. That's all there is to it. So maybe we ought to kick you out of the Navy. I said, oh, that's fine. I said, do whatever you want to do. I don't care. You know. So they said, well, we're not going to kick you out of the Navy, for Christ's sake. That's stupid. This captain at the hospital made this decision. He said, I can either throw you out or not. He said, what do you want to do? I said, it's totally up to you. I said, I signed up for 3.5 years or 4 years, whatever I'm in for. I'll stay in if that's what you want me to do. I said, well, you can send me home. I don't care. And he said, well, I'm going to keep you in. I said, fine. So this is a huge Navy base. So they go over to the Navy depot there, and they say, we have this ensign. I was just about to make JG down here. And we'd like to send him over there. And I said, I need another goddamn ensign like I need, you know, a hole in the head. He said, we don't need him. So he looked at my file again, and he said, you're a lawyer. I said, that's right. He said, are you admitted to the bar? I said, yeah, I'm admitted to the bar. So he calls the district naval officer, because it was a naval command. They had a district naval officer. So he calls this captain over there and says, I got this ensign lawyer over here. He says, send him over. I had temporary duty there for 45 days. And during 45 days, I think I did 42 courts martials. And as defense counsel, which was the crappy end of the deal, as you could tell, including a death penalty case, which was very interesting. Coincidences of life. Because of that independent duty thing, and because of the decision that the captain made, when that temporary duty was over, he sent me back to Philadelphia, thank you, to the Naval Air Command, GSSO, ASO up at Robbins Avenue in North Philadelphia, big base up there, supply base. The captain, who had just gotten that command, Bob Northwood, when I showed up, Bob said, nifty guy, subsequently became vice president of Mead Paper. First-rate guy. He said, Bob, you're here. He said, I don't have a billet in this command under Lieutenant Commander that is available at this time. He said, but I look at your experience and your maturity, and I think that you can handle this job. So he said, you will be in charge of all contract administration, which is the purchase contracts for all of the hardware and equipment in the Navy ships, including the nuclear subs, including
everything. And I was an ensign at that time. About 2 weeks later, I got my other, and I became a JG. So I was a JG, a lieutenant commander, commander of the village, and kept that for the rest of my tour of duty. And that's where I was out of the Navy. All right. The experience in law school with Jeff Forty in the municipal law, legislative, regulatory stuff gave me instruction that was so valuable to my job down here in Washington when I finally ended up here as a lobbyist, as an association manager, as an industry manager. If I had been really smart, look at the fortuity of this. The municipal law part of bonding and everything, if I had followed that, I would have ended up like Bill Simon. Well, Bill Simon is a billionaire today. My career path went in a different direction because when I got out of the Navy, all the experience I had in purchasing and dealing with people in industry, one of the things I did was to restructure the procurement system for paint. Navy buys a lot of paint. The Navy was single service procurement for all paint, for all of the services, and I ran that. And I created that system, or reformed the system. The guy who was the head of the Paint and Coatings Association, National Paint Varnish and Lacquer Association at that time, was interested in me. His number two guy, he was a general, his number two was a colonel. The colonel came to see me, and I worked with them because all of their members were interested in procurement at that time, because bid business was important to, you know, the Sherwin-Williamses and the Gliddens and the DuPonts and a lot of that people, because that kept them in overhead. And there were a lot of small companies in there that weren't too honest or ethical, and they were the problem. So because of my Navy experience, because of my law school experience, because of the fortuity that when I got out, I said, I'm not going back to practice law. I went around and Jeff Fordham sent me to some of the best firms in town, and I had at that time 3 children and the 4th on the way, and $7,000 a year was all that they could make available to you to start. And Red Elliott, Colonel Red Elliott from National Paint, Varnish and Lacquer Association came up to see me. He said, Bob, he said, would you be interested in coming to Washington? And like that, I said, yeah, I think I'd like that. That's how I got to Washington. It's that simple. If I hadn't volunteered to go to the Navy, if I hadn't done a lot of other things, all of those experiences ended up, one of the best things, people said, geez, why did you ever enlist? Didn't you? You wasted 4 years. I learned more in those 4 years about management. I mean, I had hundreds of people that I was responsible for. Millions and millions of dollars. I closed down the nuclear submarine program at one time because I defaulted a contractor. I closed down the whole Pacific Fleet because I wouldn't allow them to land or take off any airplanes because the foam, firefighting foam that had been sent, wasn't up to spec. And I froze the whole system. I had, you know, Admiral Rickover call me on the phone and cut me a new one. You can't do this. And I said, I'm sorry, Admiral, it's my responsibility. You know, and Bob Northwood said, you're right, he's wrong, I'll stand behind you. Jeff Fordham, you're right, I'm now secure in my knowledge that you've researched this, I stand behind you, I'll publish it. Those were things that to me as a manager I learned, you know, so that when I manage 300 people here and the lawyers come in and the scientists come in and the you know, the lobbyists come in and say, this is what we have to do, this is right, good, I'll stand behind you. I never was afraid to do that. Because the other thing I learned from my experiences, particularly law school, was I knew how to think. I knew how to solve problems. I knew how to analyze problems. So I knew that the spade work, the research work, the vetting, the peer reviewing, the best talent had been applied. And that's not risk. That just takes a little courage, takes a little bit of leadership, takes a little bit of foresight. And without that, you don't get anywhere. So that's what my educational background is, and that's
Very interesting. I have a couple brief questions just to back up a little bit. Going to college, you had no one in your family that had college experience.
That's correct. And my uncles had gone to college, yes.
Okay.
My uncles and my aunts. My mother was the oldest. Well, she was the second oldest in the family, but she got married relatively early. And my father was a wealthy man. I mean, they had cars and speedboats and weekends at the Bellevue and all of that, so that was not a matter of concern until it cratered.
So it was it your real decision to enter college yet? Were you pushed?
It was never
into
a question
that?
In my mind. Okay. My father and my mother both encouraged me, of course.
Okay.
Of course they did. But there was never a question in my mind but that I wouldn't go. I was one of the things that I always said I was a reader. My best gifts at Christmas were always books. And I always was fascinated, and to this day I'm fascinated, by people in their careers, biography, how they got there. And I always admired, you know, the leaders of industry and the leaders of the world. I'd say, well, you know, how did this happen? And, you know, I've looked at it very carefully, and there is an enormous degree of fortuity involved in all of this. Whether it be family money or this path versus that path. And I tell you, you know, I often look and I see Bill Simon, who I know and worked with Bill, and he was here in Washington at Treasury and after that. Bill is a brilliant man and, as I said, made fortunes by doing what he has done in the bond market. As I look back, you know, I say, boy, I was so lucky that I took the path I did. I did very well financially. But that's irrelevant. I worked with the best people, the most creative, concerned, committed people. I mean, there's not another industry in the world, given my choice, that I would take over the chemical industry. Not another. And the abuse that this industry takes, in spite of its good intentions and good works, has always been a catalyst to me, you know, to fight harder and to justify and to try and convince people that you are overlooking one of the great values that exist in the world and great industries. So, you know, I look back and I said, practice of law. I enjoyed court work. I was great at moot court. You know, I can obviously talk. I can obviously communicate. I've done it throughout my career here in Washington. My father used to say to me, do you miss the practice of law? I said, Dad, I practice law every day. And I said, it's just, you know, a different kind of law. And I'll tell you something. What I created in CMA is probably the best boutique law firm in this town. We've got 15 attorneys on staff here. You know, we spend millions on our legal advocacy function. And I managed those people. I brought them here. I trained them. I worked with them. And to me, that's a great benefit. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it. And I knew enough that I could manage them and not interfere. Not interfere.
Just out of curiosity, You handled an awful lot of court-martial cases in the Navy in a short period of time. Was that unusual?
No. It was one of the characteristics that troubled me the most, and a lesson that I learned in personnel as well. These were all desertion cases, or AWOL cases. And every one of them I lost. Every single one of them. And I lost because it was obvious that these kids did not understand their responsibilities. And for that, I blame the Navy. And it it was a lesson to me. Number one, almost every one of these kids had poor education. Number two, almost every one of them came from a broken family or no good parental guidance. Number three, they joined the Navy because they thought they were going to get something better than where they were. If you stopped and looked at their background, their whole history of experience was if they didn't like something, they walked away from it. Went to work at the Safeway. Well, screw, I don't like that. Went to work at a gas station. Well, my hands got dirty. Went to work for an automotive repair shop. Well, it's noisy in there. I don't like that. Went to work somewhere. Well, the guy promised me this and he didn't give it to me. So they look at the Navy or the military and they say, three hots and a flop. They go down to the recruiter and they say, I want to work with airplanes. The guy says, sure, you can work with airplanes in the Navy. Or I want to go to sea. Sure, you can go to sea at the Navy. Or I want to do this. Sure, we'll let you do that. And the next thing you know, the kid finds that instead of being on an aircraft carrier where he wants to be, you know, he's swabbing out toilets at some land facility, or he's working in a motor pool, or he's working in a food function, and he says, I don't like this, so he walks. He goes off on liberty on the weekend, decides I'm not going to go back. Just chucks the uniform. Well, it's different. You raised your hand. See? That was what it was all about.
Okay.
And every case was the same. It was just like a cookie cutter. And the result was the same. They all got dishonorable discharges, and they all got, you know, brig time, and they all got kicked out. And it was sad. It was truly sad. And, you know, the most I could do, which I did, and the ultimate of this was the death penalty case that I tried, which was a man under almost the same circumstances who was during the time of war, though. Went AWOL, met a girl, went home with her to her uncle's farm. To make the long story short, this was a guy with not a lot of education again, but he fell in love with this girl and married her, lived with the uncle. Her uncle was not aware that he was military. Had five or six children, ended up running the farm, which was a dairy farm. And then he was apprehended. This is some 20 years later, almost. His children were there. Everybody was a hardworking, fine person, everything else. When I first met them and this case was given to me, I said, look, you guys have got to get outside counsel on this. I said, I don't know how much longer I'm going to be here. I'm not qualified to handle something of this magnitude. This is going to be an appeal, an appeal, an appeal. I said, you better find yourself an attorney. And I found them a law firm in Charleston and got them outside counsel, and the uncle was paying the outside counsel. And this guy was convicted. He was convicted. It was sad. Now, it went on appeal. And he did not get the death penalty. He did get a dishonorable discharge, and he did get a jail term out of this thing, which I found out subsequent. But I sat there, and there were captains. One of the captains, who was from the hospital, that had treated me when I was over in the hospital in Charleston. And this guy had tears coming down his face. You know, and I went up and spoke to him. I said, you know, this is just the extreme of what you and I have been looking at for the past 2 months. I said, every one of these kids that comes in here is just as sad a case, in my opinion. So that, you know, what it said to me is that how you recruit people, the expectations that you give them, the training that you give them. My greatest success here at CMA is being able to find good people and creating an environment, having the latitude, the resources to create an environment within which those people can function effectively. And that's totally different. Totally different than it ever was, and totally different than most other organizations in this town.
Well, that I would like to talk a little bit about your pre-CMA time, but that, I'd like to hold that thought, because part of what we've been talking about in our other interviews is this whole idea of creativity and how you nurture that and how you foster people to be creative and innovative, and what atmosphere is conducive to that and what's restrictive. Or maybe we should, while we're in that mode, why don't we just continue with that thought for a little bit as to how do you encourage people to be innovative and creative?
I use the term environment. One of the conditions of my taking this job 17, 18 years ago was that this kind of a facility be constructed. Where we were was not conducive to doing the job that needed to be done. The greatest illustration of that was that the leadership of the industry did not meet in the building. The leadership of the industry always met in Washington in a hotel. Okay, they would meet in the Madison Hotel, they would meet in the Mayflower, they would meet in some nice property. Never met in the headquarters building. And for good reason. It was a dump. It was pitiful. And I was particularly mindful of this. And I want you to know that in my previous 21 years at National Paint and Coatings Association, I constructed the model for what I brought to MCA/CMA. Much of what I did do here, I had tested there, had started there, had constructed to a large degree there. It was the chemical company supplier members of NPCA who knew Bob Rowland and knew that MCA needed to be reformed, who brought me here. DuPont, Dow, Monsanto, Carbide, those people knew, they were all members.
Okay.
Over at the Paint Association as suppliers. They were my board members. Dick Heckert was on my board. Okay, a lot of those people were on my board over there. So they could see that the things that were being done at little old paint and coatings were the kinds of things that ought to be done for the big chemical industry but weren't being done. Right, back to the question. When they hired me, I insisted that we be interviewed. I'd be interviewed over there because it was a beautiful old mansion. You've never seen it, but it's very historic. It was the Bell Morton Mansion. It was the vice president's home. It was is a magnificent edifice. And people would say, boy, you live pretty good. This is a heck of a lot better than my office back at the factory. I said, precisely, because we're not selling paint. We're selling beauty. We're not selling raw materials, we're selling finished goods. A look. I said, this building should reflect what the coatings industry, the decorative products industry is all about. And I said, the fact that we are able to do that is an advantage. The other thing was, I started there on the concept of involvement, member involvement. There was a very popular feeling as association management became more of a profession, not just a skill. And this was back in the 60s primarily. The concept of the hired gun became very popular. That you hired some smart guy to represent your industry. Now, in the old days, they hired generals and admirals and ex-congressmen and senators because they knew it all, which is bull hockey. They didn't know it all. They knew parts of government. They knew how to access it. And most of them were very bad managers, okay? And most of their organizations weren't all that effective, unless you were operating under wartime conditions for allocations and that kind of thing. As we got into the 60s and this increase in government control, regulation, legislation, environmental, consumer activities, all of the big government concepts coming to bear. It was necessary that you have qualified people, very qualified people, in order to meet that kind of a challenge. The hired gun wasn't the answer. It would work for a while. And a lot of people thought that, okay, I'll speak for the industry. I'll be the czar. I'll be the commissioner. And the truth of the matter is, it works to a degree. If nobody is representing the industry, that's better than nothing. But what people really want is for the industry to manifest itself. Congressmen and senators and presidents and what have you don't want to talk to a hired administrator. They want to talk to a CEO of a company. Conversely, if you are going to effectively represent your industry, you must know what that industry believes and what they think. Now, when I was first hired, I wrote down, I'm sorry I didn't bring it with me because I have it, on a yellow fool's cap, some 15 items. And I went to my first executive committee and I read those 15 items. One of those 15 items was to change the name from MCA to CMA. And people said, well, why? And it was not an easy thing to do, I will tell you. It's the closest to a public hanging that these people have been in a long time. I said, all right, you are Senator Kennedy, and you are now going to regulate the chemical industry, or you're concerned about something in the chemical industry. Now, you don't know squat about the chemical industry. You don't know squat about anything. So you go to your staff guy and you say, we're going to have hearings on this chemical regulation bill, and what I want you to do is get me some chemical people in here. So this guy, who, you know, is a political science major from Harvard, he doesn't know anything either, so what's he going to do? He has to find some place to go if he doesn't know who all the company. Oh, sure, there's DuPont, there's Dow, but who else and what else and how do we organize it and what have you. So they want to talk to the chemical industry in the phone book. If you looked in the phone book for something about the chemical industry, would you look under M or would you look under C? I would look under C. Okay, so now the second thing is, manufacturing chemists, and you've got a logo with this beaker and things, you know, and people holding stuff up to the light, you know, and brown bottles. I said, doesn't that give you the image of somebody working in a remote back room laboratory, some mystique kind of thing? Not what the products of the industry really are. I said, Chemical Manufacturers Association. What's that say? It says we represent chemical manufacturers, and that's what we ought to be. I said, it's that simple to me. Now, the reason why they came looking for somebody was because they had been badly beaten on the Toxic Substances Control Act, TSCA. They got badly beaten. And they got badly beaten because, one, they weren't organized. They really didn't know advocacy. Two, they were not organized personally and professionally. And three, they had no organization to go out and represent them and to build the staff support for these people. They fought all the time, and they did what they normally did. They said, well, okay, Dow believes this, and DuPont believes that, and Carbide believes this, and somebody else, Shell, believes that. Charlie, you're the CEO of this company. You're going to be the chairman of this committee. You're going to organize our TSCA thing. And right away, the other five guys are saying, that's a son of a bitch. He's never going to represent me, and he's never going to do it right, da-da-da-da-da-da. This was a climate. This is part of the environment that I talk about. Well, you had a bad physical environment. You had a bad professional environment. You had a bad membership environment. You had a bad everything environment. Nothing was working. And nobody had any goals or objectives. So
one of the first things I said was, we're going to change the name. We're going to get a flag that we can all march behind. And a flag that says to all of those guys out there who are looking for us, here we are. Here we are. You want to talk chemicals? Come see us. Now, the risk is, you got your flag. What do you have under the flag? How are you going to deal with these people? What, idiots? Disorganized, everybody talking for himself, doing what they want to do? We're going to have to find out how to organize ourselves under this flag. You come to town, your limos pick you up at the airport, drive you up to Connecticut Avenue, park outside this drugstore, go through this building with the hot dog smell, up to the second floor, mind you, not the 10th floor, which is a government office, but to the second floor. No air conditioning that functions. You open the windows and there's a bus stop down there. And all you hear is vroom and the clouds. And you wouldn't stop there for 10 minutes. So you go meet at the Madison Hotel. I said, well, from now on, we're going to meet up here. Because I'll tell you something, we're moving. We need a headquarters building that reflects this industry and is a place that peer professionals can come to meet. The day I was interviewed in my office, my very elegant office, at National Paint and Coatings Association by John Henske on behalf of the board of directors. And I insisted that it be at that place. And I said, John, look around. What do you see? He says, this is very nice. I said, exactly. I said, why don't you meet in your own headquarters building? Well, it's not so nice. I said, how do you think your employees feel about it? Well, they don't like to go there. How do you think the staff feels about it? I said, I can tell you that. They hate it. There was a perimeter around a parking lot. It was a building that had a parking lot up through the middle of the building. And so all the offices were on an outside perimeter. And all the corridor doors were locked. Because when you got out of the parking lot, you could walk into any of the offices, and there were strangers there. And there was no way you could go from one office to the other around the perimeter other than going into this inner corridor and rushing like hell around there. Nobody knew anybody. And there were no meeting facilities. But I asked John a very important question. I said, John, what do you think the relationship between your staff and the staff of the association should be? And without a hesitation, he said, peer professional. I said, at that moment, you hired me. You hired me. So, how do you foster creativity and innovation? Number one, you create a physical environment within which people can operate, that they can meet. First thing I did when I started, got the industry behind us. I'll talk more about that. We leased this whole building, subleased the upper part. We took this. I constructed 15 conference rooms, furnished them as nicely as we could. All the offices waited. We did the conference rooms first because what we wanted to do was create a place where that peer professional relationship could happen, where the guys would go from their office to here and have a Coke, coffee, lunch served in the building. You know, they pay for it, but it's convenient for them. You need a telephone, it's here. You need a tape, it's here. You need a fax machine, you need something else, it's here. It's all state of the art that you need. You know, you want to. So after a couple of years, we got into this building. I never unpacked my boxes. My boxes stood against the wall in my office up on Connecticut Avenue. And every time a member came in, every time a staff member came in, they'd look at it and they'd say, aren't you ever going to unpack? I said, not here. I don't work here. I'll work somewhere else, but I won't work here. This is not where we're permanently going to be. All right, so we got that. Second thing was, how do you organize the people? People on the staff, I went into a staff meeting. I said, we're going to have a staff meeting every Monday morning. Vice presidents will all be here. This is the way it is. And I won't bore you with how many people I fired and how rapidly I did it. I did everything that was allowed under the law, but I got rid of a lot of dead wood. People that were sent to the association from member companies because they didn't know what to do with them and they weren't doing the job. So I went out and started hiring young, smart, aggressive people. I went to the first staff meeting with the vice presidents and we were talking about it. At that time, I think it was Superfund. I mean, Superfund has been my life, and staff was arguing about something. I said, wait a minute, what's the association's position on this? And they didn't know. I said, what's the staff's position on this? They didn't know. I said, fine, I'm leaving the meeting. When you guys decide what you think the position of this industry and this association should be, you come back and call me, and then I'll listen to you, and we'll see where we go from there. And that literally happened. I mean, literally. They were so disorganized, they didn't know what they wanted, much less what the members wanted. At this time, one of the major problems we had was Love Canal. And Love Canal was Hooker Chemical Company. And Hooker Chemical was persona non grata within MCA at that time. Don't remember the fellow's name, Jack something or other. And he had been on the executive committee. And he came down and visited with me and told me the story of Love Canal, showed me some of the papers. And I said, this is amazing. And clearly the case, which has been proven, that the city was at fault, the school district, by going in there and breaking the cap, and they had all the authority and all the legality behind them to put that dump there, and everybody knew it. These guys went in and turned it over, sold it to developers, broke the cap, and that's what caused the problem. The dumping of that sludge and stuff in there was legal at that time under the law of the state of New York and the county and city of Buffalo. So this was all bull hockey. Now, I was convinced enough as a lawyer and as a businessman that this was wrong. I carried that fight to the Wall Street Journal, which was the first newspaper to ever come out and say, hey, the industry was right here. It's the damn city and the school board that was wrong. And I took the papers up and sat down and showed them to them. But I went to the executive committee and I created an agenda one day at one of our meetings and I had Hooker come in. And the chairman of the executive committee said, why are you doing this? I said, it's very simple. There, but for the grace of God, goes every one of you guys around this table. I said, you just don't know. You can turn your back on Hooker, but you can't turn your back on this problem, and that's what you're doing. You're setting yourselves up for a great fall. So I had him come in. I just can't think of his name. When the meeting was over, he left. And the executive committee sat around and talked, and I told them exactly that. I said, gentlemen, there but for the grace of God go each and every one of you in your companies. I said, this is not how this organization should function. It's not how this industry should function. I said, we must support one another. We must decide policy. We must do the right thing. And we must do it as quickly and as publicly as we possibly can. Okay. The next thing was, your responsibility is to run this industry. You control it. It's not my job to do that. I manage the association for you. If John Henske's philosophy, belief, and mine of peer professionalism is going to happen, I need your best people working with my best people. And I need it in an environment where they can be creative and comfortable. And I need it with the understanding that you will support us. You will support us, not just financially, but philosophically, personally, by making policy, by doing the things that need to be done to carry this industry forward. I need your commitment. They were ready for that. In the synergism, the fortuity, I was there. I believed that I had tested it. They were there. They understood it. They believed it. Now, it didn't happen overnight. How much of this is all public record?
You control who has access to it. So there's release forms in which you can control it, so it's up to you. And
you have the ultimate
control over what we have.
One of the most unique things in CMA is called the Greenbrier procedure. Are you familiar with that?
I've heard about it.
Okay. The Greenbrier procedure came about in this fashion. And what it is it's a statement in our yearbook. It's printed in the book. And it says that if you as a company or a member disagree with the position of CMA, you can publicly express yourself by writing to the president of the association. And the president of the association will arrange for you to bring your position before the board or executive committee of the association, at which time your position will be debated. And if you carry the day, fine. If you don't carry the day, then you cannot publicly say to the rest of the world that I am CMA and I disagree with them and blah, blah, blah. If you start that divisiveness within the organization, you're going to destroy it. And we only have, you know, a couple hundred members. So you can't afford to go down that path. The worst part of it is, though, what it does to your adversaries, what it does to your advocacy program. It fragments you in the eyes of the public, and once they divide you, they conquer you. So what you can do is say, I'm still a member of CMA, I still believe in CMA, I support CMA, I part company with them on this issue, my belief on this issue is as follows, the association's position will be stated by them. Okay? And you do not go out and badmouth the association. Because the next time, you know, it may be you who is in the majority and somebody else is in the minority. So let's hold this together. That came about because a member company went to Capitol Hill and one of their staff people started to cut a deal and created this kind of bifurcation, and it caused serious problem for our advocacy. When I found out this was going on, I found out which company it was, and I called the chairman of that company and I said, your employee can no longer represent this association. He will no longer be in our committees. He is no longer welcome in this building. And I want you to know that's how strongly I feel about this. And I want you to know that you must do something about it. Otherwise, you're going to be persona non grata in the board of directors and executive committee. That man removed that employee from that function, came to Washington, and visited with all of my staff and apologized to them publicly for what one of his employees did. And it was just at that time that we were having a board meeting, an executive committee meeting at the Greenbrier. And Bark Morley was the chairman of the executive committee, and I told him, I said, Bark, I've got my resignation in my pocket. I will not tolerate this. And I said, if I go, I'll take the rest of the staff with me. They won't tolerate it. I said, you don't send us out on a limb and then saw it off. We're not hired guns. Remember what we are? Remember how we run an association? And we had a closed meeting, and I ran a seminar for 2.5 hours with the executive committee on how you run an association and what the responsibility of the policy-making members, the guys who are the shareholders, who are the policy holders in this association. And we wrote that down. And that was what became the Greenbrier procedure. I don't know of another association that has it. The chamber tried to put something like that in. Others have looked at it. The man whose company this was John Hensky. And isn't that interesting? John was so mortified, was so angry. I used to call John the Protestant Pope because he was so circumspect. He was so ethical. He was so concerned about always doing the right thing, and he just went out of his way to make sure that it was done correctly. And it was so unfortunate that it would be John and Olin that had hired me, had been so instrumental in the creation of what CMA was going to be and is, that it should be one of his people that did this. But that incident was part of the tempering of this concept. That and other incidents, again involving John Hensky, when John was outgoing and part of the selection committee for the next series of officers, you know as well as I that there was some serious managerial conflict and corporate career conflict between John Hensky and Paul Orvis. John was at Dow while Paul was there. They were peers. They were arguing and fighting for the same job. Paul won. John left and went to Olin. And that's how he got there. The right guy to succeed at this particular meeting was Paul Arfus. We needed a big company guy with huge stature, and Paul was busy as heck reforming Dow and taking them worldwide and everything else. And Henske was chairing this meeting, and I said, I think the candidate we ought to look at and we should consider is Paul Arfus. The sooner the better. And John said, well, he'll never accept it. I said, that's irrelevant. I said, the important question is that we ask him. I said, if he does accept it, then how much further ahead are we? And if he doesn't accept it, we haven't hurt him. We have flattered him. And he said, well, who's going to call him? I said, you are. I said, John, you know you're the only person that can do that, and it's a job you should do. Well, he did it. And Paul said, I'll call you back tomorrow and let you know. And then that afternoon, that evening, Paul called me. And he said, I want to do this. He said, I want to do it because I support and believe in what you are trying to do in CMA. And he said, you know I'm busy and I don't have time for this. I said, Paul, I know that. And I said, I told him the story of J.P. Morgan walking the fellow across the floor of the stock exchange. The guy wanted to borrow money, and J.P. said, I can't lend you money. He said, I don't do that. He said, but I can assist you in some way. And he said, meet me at the stock exchange. And he met him, and he walked him across the floor of the exchange and out the other door. And he said, there, now I've done as much for you as I possibly can. Having been seen with J.P. Morgan, the guy got all the money he ever wanted. And Paul knew this. Paul knew this, and I knew this. And I said, this is what I need you to do. Put your arm around me and around CMA and legitimize what we're doing in the eyes of the most important member of the chemical industry right now. I said, because from this day on, no CEO of a major chemical company can say, I can't do this. I don't have the time. I can't afford it. Because I can always say, well, if Paul Arfus could, why the hell can't you? And Paul and I worked out a deal. All of those things led to the creation of the environment, which is based on the points that I made to you. And that's what CMA is all about. That's what it's all about.
Would you characterize the industry at the time you took over in 78? Well, the reputation the industry had at the time of Silent Spring, which was a little bit earlier, was simply one of just stonewalling.
Yes, no question.
And they tried to shoot Rachel Carson down because they questioned all kinds of things.
They made her a heroine, just like General Motors made Ralph Nader a hero. Yeah. Same deal, no question. And they also were in that stage of industry where people believe that bullshit beat brains. We'll just do another study or send some more smoke out or do this. That's not it. We've beaten people here. We've won every major battle we've gone into with brains because we had better data. We had better people. We trained. For the first 2 years, the only person that ever was on TV or radio or anything was me. And I told the executive committee and the board, I said, this is over. I'm doing this to show you that it can be done. I'm doing this to carry your water for you. It's not my job. It's your job. And you're going to be trained to do it. And we created a training program. And today, people come up to me constantly and say, how do you get such good guys to go down and testify? I said, we train them. We have a murder board. All this equipment, we videotape them. We put them before a panel. We ask them the questions. We punch a button. We show them how the question was answered in the hearing yesterday or last year when they had it. All the people who testified, who's going to be there, the kinds of questions they'll ask. When they come out of here, it's like, Jesus, I've already done it. And once they do it, once, and they walk away having been prepared, having been a CEO and accomplished something, they say, this is easy. I like this. And that's why we ended up with guys like Fernandez and Bob Forney and Gene McBrayer and God, I could go on, every one of these CEOs. Frank Popoff. These guys were brilliant. We put them in the chairs, you know, and God, they just knock them dead. And then we take them on media tours. They're just wonderful. No. 1978, head in the sand. And two things. Remember the Hooker story. Not only do I not want to tell the public, and it's none of their goddamn business anyway, all I'm here to do is make money for the company and do good things. Not enough. But I don't necessarily need to tell you either, my peer in industry. And what I had to show these guys, and what we developed by simple thing. They went out of town for board meetings. And that's fine, I believe in that. I said, but now we're going to take wives. What? I said, yeah, we're going to take wives. And I said, we're going to have a dance. And we're not going to wear tuxedos. We're going to play golf. We're going to do some other stuff. Because you know Charlie, and Charlie knows Harry and Frank, because you're incestuous. You all buy and sell to one another. But you contract with one another. You drink with one another. You shoot and play golf with one another. But do you really know one another? Are you friends? Because you're going to have to be friends in order to link arms and stand up to your adversaries. And you're going to have to be friends to sit around the table and take the deep gulp and say, well, that's not in the best interest of my company, but yes, it is in the best interest of the industry, and therefore we should do it. And we created a homogeneity, a social contact as well as a professional contact. And when people leave the chairs, when people leave the industry, they say, I can't tell you how I miss CMA more than anything else. See, we created CMA as the focal point for the industry's policy, the focal point for the industry's advocacy, and the focal point for the industry's professionalism. When Frank Popoff comes to the United States from Europe and is put in the chairs of Dow, I mean, I've got Dow staff people in here saying, okay, now, how soon can we get him in the CMA chairs? Because he's not going to get an SCI medal until he gets the CMA chairmanship. He's not going to get this until he gets the CMA chairmanship. He's not going to get that until he gets on the board and finance committee. How do we get this thing organized to give this to these people? He's not going to be invited to these social functions. He's not going to be invited to these professional and political functions. How do we organize that? CMA is important. And that's what you have to have. And we had cases. George Sella, when George was chairman of American Cyanamid, had been through our chairs, and tough guy, wonderful, delightful guy as far as I'm concerned, different than anything. George said, I can't take the chairmanship because I'm really going into the pharmaceutical business, much bigger than I am in the chemical business, and I've got to spend some more time over there. I said, wait a minute. You've spent 6 years going through the chairs. You're not going to do this. I just really can't do it. Okay. Hung up the phone. I called Paul Orifice. And I said, Paul, George walking says he can't do it. Called up Ed Holmer from Exxon. I said, Ed, George can't do it. And I called those, who else did I call? I called one other. Major customer. Next day, Sella called me. First words out of his mouth, you son of a bitch, you. Hi, George. What's wrong? You sicked him on me, didn't you? I said, of course I did. Of course I did. And you know it's right. And you'll be glad. You'll be a hero. I am here to make you a hero. That's what it's all about. well, God damn it, I'll do it, you know, blah, blah, blah. And when the year was all over, and it was a Superfund year, tough decision. Boy, we had a lot of problems. And George made one of those major decisions that was not in the best interest of his company, but in the best interest of the industry, and we won the battle, and it worked out well for him and for the industry. And his next phone call was, well, you did it. I said, what? He said, you made me a hero. I said, I told you I would. See, that's all I am here for, is to create an environment that says to the member, you can accomplish things here. You'll be a hero. It says to the staff, you will get credit for the stuff you do and you will be supported, so work hard and I'll give you all the, you know, resources you need that I possibly can. And, you know, we fight like hell. Money is not easy to come by. And we've grown from 4 million to, well, today it's 100 and some million. But people are bringing more and more things here because stuff gets done. It is an environment within. I don't have to hire. I have no trouble getting people. Never have. People from the government, people from the Hill, people from other associations. They want to stand in line to get here. This is where they want to work. And that's what I've always believed, and that's what I've, you know, worked on.
Okay.
You didn't have an easy road when you started.
No, it wasn't.
Could you tell me something about your first meeting, your multimedia presentation to the assembly?
Well, that was an eye-opener. It was intended to be flamboyant, and indeed it was. I mean, I wore a very light summer suit, you know, and I sat on a stool, and there was a floodlight that came down, and we had six screens, and, you know, the images were moving, and it was rear screen projection, and there was music, and there was dynamism, and some of the times we had tapes in there, and some of the times I spoke, and the rest of this thing, and, you know, these guys sat in the audience, you know, and just said, Jesus, MCA, this isn't, you know? And the purpose of it, and I had done this before, this is a presentation that I did similar to this that I did for the paint industry, and it went over so well that we took it to high schools around the area here and showed it to the students in their student assemblies about industry and the chemical industry in particular and how advocacy is done, things like that. So, you know, I just characterized, this was the first annual meeting that I was responsible for. I was hired in literally in June, and I was flown to the Greenbrier to see a couple of people and what have you, and then flown back to Washington. John Henske invited me to an August meeting where they were going to review the budget, and I sat there with my predecessor on the other side of John, and the committee chairman came in, and they had no money for the budget. They hadn't funded any of the programs that the committee chairman had asked for. And when the thing was over, John turned to me and he says, you can see the problem, can't you? I said, I certainly can. Well, I was then officially on board in August, I think. And we started having meetings. And aside from this Hooker event, one of the things that I just consumed them with in the first series of meetings was, I had all the committee chairmen come in, and with all the staff vice presidents, and I said, you will all sit down and prioritize your program. I said, I want to know, we've put this budget together, none of it has been funded, or very little of it has been funded. The budget has been approved. I don't know what I can do for you this year, but I said, we will do something, and next year we will do more and more and more. So they worked like hell. And this was the first time the committees and the environmental committee that was at it had a chowder and marching society. That's what it was called. They met in rump sessions. And I said, there will be no more of this. There's only one place it's going to be done. It's here. You don't like that, you're going to be fired. I can fire you. I can call. And I did. I kicked committee chairman out. Called their CEOs and told them to get out. Don't send them back again. The guy can't work in the process. Won't have it. But they all turned to. They all knew that something was going to happen, and they gave me an act of faith. And I said, I promise you I'll support you if you support me. Well, those meetings, I went into an executive committee meeting and I'd say, okay, here are the priorities from one on, and today we're talking about the environmental area. Now, here's the budget. And the chairman came in, and the staff vice president came in, and the right people presented to the executive committee saying, gentlemen, we got to have this. We got to do this. And then they'd leave. And I'd say, okay, now you can sit here and contemplate your navels, but what the hell are you going to do? Which one do you want them to do? And how many of them do you want them to do? And they got involved in the decision-making process. We went through a year or two of that. Now, the purpose of this presentation the following June was to put all of those issues on the stage, to show them the priorities, to show them what can be done, to show them what our intentions are to do it, and to give them a face, because the membership, the rank and file, had never seen this. Only people that I had dealt with was the board and the executive committee. And I had not gone out to visit all the members. Never did. Never did. I got to meet all the members in time, of course. But I never got on my list without Bob Rowland. I said, no, I want to build this thing. This will sell itself. You can't sell from an empty wagon. You got a problem, come down, I'll talk to you. I'm in your neighborhood, I'll be in to see you. But I'm not going to get on a dog and pony show. This was the dog and pony show. And these guys walked out of there and said, Jesus, something's going to happen here. And that's what they were supposed to say. Something's going to happen here. And the chairman got up and said, you can see something is happening here. Well, that served its purpose. My television appearances served their purpose. But by the time we got through the first couple of years, then we were here. 3 years, third year, we were in here. The board and executive committee knew that the association was being run by their professionals working with the staff's professionals. And if the staff wasn't good enough, Bob would get somebody good enough. And we better provide them with some more resources. And by the way, these guys came up and we created, I'll tell you, Gary Herman did a marvelous job. I hired Gary before I was ever on board here, before I ever went up to Connecticut Avenue. I hired him as our treasurer. And I knew Gary. He worked with Forest Products. They had no budgeting system. Had no budgeting system. I mean, this pocket was CMA or MCA, and this pocket was George Best, I guess. And there was no relationship between the budget and the committees. So we created a budgeting system that I think is the best. I mean, our members stand in awe of it. So if they like it, you know, it's got to be considerably better than most trade associations have ever seen. And it is a project-driven budget. And we have, you know, on one side we have the money, on the other side we have the programs, on this side we have the people, on this side we have the programs and objectives and goals, and you come down to the bottom of the page and you say, well, Jesus, this is more than we think we can afford. Fine. Now you can go over to this side of the page and this side of the page and you tell me which one you want to change. And the committee chairmen come into the finance committee and make their presentations. They look their bosses in the eye and say, you got to do this. And here's why you got to do it. And the boss can say, well, I'm sorry, I can't do it. That doesn't make me a son of a bitch. It doesn't make them frustrated. They understand. Because one of these days, they're going to be on this side of the table. And that's what this is. We created a farm system of people coming through the chairs from the committees up to the board of directors.
Do you think that this was also the time when the nature of the CEO was changing in the industry?
Oh, sure. I think more and more of them knew that they could run, but they couldn't hide. Their people were telling them. When we started bringing them in here for audiovisual, for advocacy training, a lot of them were doing that stuff at home, too. They were starting that at home. So they were taping things, and they were going to, a lot of their ad agencies were putting on these training sessions for them in television and advocacy journalism and ambush journalism and all the rest of that. So some of them had been trained in that, and when they saw it happening here, they encouraged it here, they encouraged it at home. The timing, and make no mistake about it, the fortuity of what I wanted to do and what they knew they had to do, they just needed somebody to push them. They needed somebody to structure it for them. And they needed somebody to say, yes, we can do it and show results. So the timing was right, no question about it. No question about it.
You said during those early years, Superfund was and always has been a part of your life, but I suppose the benchmark event was Bhopal.
Bhopal was indeed a benchmark event in a lot of respects. It was a benchmark event, number one, because it took us to the next plateau that was really called proactive. Up until then, we had been doing good advocacy. Up until then, we had been doing good representation, good public relations. We were getting known. Bhopal took us beyond that to proactivity. And we'll say more about that. That's point number one. Point number two was, Bhopal clearly put the spotlight on the global characteristic of the chemical industry. Anywhere, anytime, any place. We're everywhere. This is Union Carbide. Couldn't happen here in the United States, but over there in India it happened, and it's a U.S. company in India. Jesus, these chemical companies are everywhere. It's ubiquitous. It's, well, those two points. The international point is relatively easy to deal with, but it helped enormously in something that I had been trying to do since I came here, and that was the creation of an international chemical industry organization. Chemical industry has been global for a long time. Most of this industry, you know, purchased from overseas, and it was during the war that a lot of our resources in organic chemistry were developed here. And after the war, we spread very rapidly and competed with the Germans and the French and the Italians and everybody else, primarily the Germans, the English. The chemical industry in the United States has always been global. I mean, we have traded people in and out of the industry very easily. We not just went into partnerships and economic relationships, but we bought, purchased, established, built overseas. So we've had a presence around the world, much more so than other companies, other industries. We also were very successful. I think the people in the United States are the best marketers in the world. I don't care what anybody says. And they believe it, and that's important. We made a lot of money selling overseas. This association was not established to do advocacy on economics or on trade. Our member companies do that far better than we could, and they've been doing it a lot longer than we've ever been interested in it. Our job was advocacy to create a level playing field through the trade negotiations, the GATT and the NAFTA and things like that, and Buy American. That's what they look to the association for. So we've been involved in the trade area for that. As this impetus of regulatory activity came to the United States, it was not long thereafter that it happened in Europe as well. And this was pushed by the environmental movement and pushed by the consumerism movement and pushed by the other things, the Greens. So that people in Europe, I remember the first month that I was in my office in Connecticut Avenue, representatives of the German Association and German industry came to see us and said, it's so, so difficult for you and so poor for you. People in Germany understand that the chemical industry and chemistry is a wonderful thing, and we have a special bond with the public and with the media and with other people that we would never experience what you have over here. 3-4 years later, they were back in my office saying, tell us, how do we deal with this? How do you deal with it? What can we do? So that was indicative of a different kind of global interest of the chemical industry, and said to me that we in CMA need to provide leadership here. And again, it was a case of reaching out to the leadership of the industry, the CEOs of the companies, and we created a mission group that we went around. I had spent, you know, years introducing myself, going to their meetings overseas, inviting those people here, my peers in the association community. But then I said, okay, Bob Kennedy, and okay, Mr. CEO over here, the guys you're doing business with at Herxt and Bayer and ICI are your counterparts over there, let's get together and start doing it. And I had, you know, known my counterparts, and I felt this could be brought together, and eventually it did. And that's another story, and it's an important story, I think. Witness the fact I got the medal partially for that. I think it's a big story and an important story. But that was one aspect. The big thing here at CMA was this becoming proactive. You will recall there was a hiatus of about a year, I suppose, between Bhopal and Institute, West Virginia. And a lot of people forget about Institute, which was also Union Carbide, when they had a release of the same material at Institute. And they said, oh, it can't happen here. Well, here it did happen here. And it happened with the same company. What we did in Bhopal was for the first time became the command center for a major issue that affected the entire industry, an attack that was going to be severe. This was what we learned in Love Canal and Hooker in that first executive committee meeting. And now we had it happening again. And the industry was under assault. And the response was so different. These two rooms were opened up here, and we had every wall covered. We had every staff person and every committee person working under the leadership of Geraldine Cox, Dr. Cox, who was our vice president technical. And we worked in this room. Every idea, every concern, every problem was structured. Every piece of intelligence was brought into this room. We organized a crisis center for this problem for the industry. Jerry Cox was seconded to go to every television show, every radio show, every debate. We had industry people who were qualified to speak on this. We didn't turn down a single one. We went to every editorial board, every magazine. The officers of the association and myself, and I'm an officer, went to Connecticut and sat down with Warren Anderson and said, what can we do for Union Carbide, and what do you think the industry should do for you and for the problem? We sat there and worked with them from the day they were aware of this. And that, we were successful. We were very successful. We legitimized the process that we had put in place. We legitimized the relationships that we were developing. We proved to the industry that CMA was the advocate that we hoped it could be, and that they would provide not just cover, but provide leadership. At that same time, we created, because we had Chemtrek and we had these other things, we said it's not enough that we know inside the fence line that we're good. The community doesn't believe us. They don't know because we don't let them in. We ask them to make an act of faith in the company, and then there's a leak. And sometimes we tell them about it, and sometimes we don't. So how are we going to change that? this came out of this total brainstorming thing. And Ham Hurst from NALCO and Jerry and a couple of others and some other committee people, we were meeting down in the executive conference room, I remember well. And I said, we've got to do something here. And I said, I've got an idea. And I coined the phrase CARE, C-A-E-R, Community Awareness Emergency Response. I said, we're good in emergency response. We can put the lid on the pots, and we can put the fires out, and we can, you know, have mutual assistance and all this stuff. It's the CA part that we stink at, the community awareness. So we coined this phrase, and we started working on the CARE program. And the CAER program was exactly that, had two parts to it. And we had a committee that dealt with one and a committee that dealt with the other. And we developed a terrific program. At the same time, our friends in Canada, same companies by and large, in the Canadian Chemical Producers Association, and John Belanger was my counterpart. And John and I were friends, meeting together all the time, going to Europe together. We got involved in this. They came down and we gave them Chemtrek. They came down and we gave them CARE. You know, we gave them all this other stuff. And they sat down and started to play with it. And the problem that we had was a pragmatic one. It wasn't the Carbides and the Dows and the DuPonts and what have you that were the difficulty. It was the smaller companies. Smaller companies. When you said, you got to go out and deal with the community. You know, we're not sure about this. So, as we got a year or so into this, and we started to audit, we found out, and I remember Hal Sorgenti was very big on this, and so was Bob Kennedy, because they were in the chairs together, and we were having a planning meeting at the Greenbrier. And I had started this. We were now ready at the stage where I would get together with the officers, outgoing and incoming, and just myself. And we'd sit together for a whole day, and we'd say, okay, you've seen the annual reports, you know what we're doing, here's the budget, here's everything else. Where are we good? Where are we bad? Where are we screwing up? What do we need to do? What is your view of the future? What do you think's going to happen? And we would use that as just a anecdotal opportunity for the leadership of the business to get together and think about what we were going to do. And the subject came up, you know, two things all the time. How do we make sure that everybody contributes to the sweat equity of the association, the peer professionalism? Because we keep tabs of it. And we can see that, you know, Dow's got 200 and some people in here all the time, and this company only has one person, or none. How can we make them do their share of the sweat equity? And two, how do we get everybody to follow and march to the same song of proactivity, corporate proactivity? How can we make them do it? Well, you know, that's not something to do. You know, this is not the kind of business we're ended up in. Well, our friends in Canada were playing with the CARE program. And they came to the same conclusion, and they said, maybe we ought to package all of these good things together, not just community awareness and emergency response, but standards programs that we have and other management training programs and other awareness. And they came up with the term responsible CARE. And at this planning session, Kennedy said, you know, my guy in Canada was telling me something about a program they're working on up there. So I got hold of John Belanger, and he said, yeah, he said, we're trying this thing. And he said, what we're thinking about is we're creating these management practice codes, these corporate practice codes, performance standards, if you will. I said, Jesus God, I thought they were hanging when we wanted to change the name of the association. What'll happen here? So we went back to the planning session with the officers, and they said, that's what we need. But God, will we ever get it? To make the long story short, that became responsible CARE. And responsible CARE, we knew, would only work if everybody was made to do it. And therefore, it had to be a condition of membership. And That's what it was. And when it was voted in a membership meeting, one vote per company, every member of the association save one voted in favor of it. That company supports responsible care, has signed on for it. The guy who came to the meeting was their new general counsel, who came from IBM. And he said, there's no way that I can, you know, and we had all kinds of legal opinions saying that this was fine and everything else. He said, I just can't bring myself to believe that this is right, and therefore I'm not going to vote for it. And we said, well, you know, 199 to 1, I don't give a damn, we can go with that. So it was voted. And today you have responsible care throughout the industry, around the world. It is utilized to the fullest degree possible by our European counterparts. And I say fullest degree possible because they have different laws and they have different vernacular. And using the same terms doesn't always work, as you know, overseas. But the International Council of Chemical Associations has endorsed responsible care. We are training people in responsible care. When we did the CAER program, Community Awareness Emergency Response, the United Nations picked that up through ICCA and called that APEL, Awareness and Preparedness at the Local Level. And we, the chemical industry in the United States and Europe and Australia and Japan, provide resource people and money to the United Nations Environmental Program, UNEP, to have seminars and training in 30 countries around the world on CAER. And now we are looking to go beyond that. When I retired, the people in UNEP were wondering, you know, is there a way that the industry and United Nations can go the next step into something like responsible care? Well, our feeling is that any industry that is growing in any emerging nation that wants to develop a chemical industry or chemical products industry or chemical technology can start from the beginning with this kind of thing and ought to. And damn well, if they're going to use the resources of any developed country or company, they're going to have to, because the criteria for responsible care is you will carry it with you to any country that you go to.
Do you have any, what's the word I want to use, policing mechanism?
That's
not the right word, I suppose, but that's what I mean. How do you
well,
ensure
we have,
this is
there is an auditing system of sorts. Yeah, we get reports from the company, and we have a field staff. Our concept, though, is to assist, not to discipline. So we go out to make sure the company can comply, and there are performance criteria that they have to meet at different stages. And if they don't meet it, we send the team out to help them. And if they don't know how to do it, then we get somebody from a company to come in and help them and show them how to do it. And that's something that has been ongoing, and to get the real detail of that, you should sit down with Dick Doyle and the people who are managing the program now. We built a field staff from member companies. We've had them, some seconded here, and some of them we've hired here full-time on staff. And that field staff goes out to assist people in doing it. We have an advisory committee in responsible care of outside Greens who have approved this program from beginning to end. They would still like some kind of an audit, outside audit system. We are, I would say, a short step or so away from that. We have internal audits, we have company audits, we have the CMA staff work, but we do not have an independent audit agency yet. The people in Europe, we're looking at ISO 9000 and things like that as a relationship to this. How that's going to play out, I don't know. But it's going to happen. It's going to happen one of these days. I'm sure of it. If you had asked me 15 years ago, do you think that you would be able to have a requirement of membership that was predicated upon performance standards in areas of health, safety, environment, and other things, transportation and all that, I would say, well, I'm not sure that I legally believe that it's possible, much less as a manager do I believe that people would do it in an industry at an association level. But management is, as I say, somebody told me once, a accomplishing things through people. And the function of a trade association, you know, I've been through this, and people ask me, what's the definition? And I've told our staff, I said, the definition of a trade association is a vehicle for problem solving. That's it. Nobody believed that we would be running insurance companies. And I created and started and ran a very successful insurance company at paint and coatings for many years. Offshore insurance company. And we became so competitive that we drove the domestic people back into the business. Back into the business. Because they ignored it. And I said, well, screw you, I'll start my own offshore. We had the first insurance company offshore where the underwriting was completely done outside of the industry. Completely. I mean, it was 100%. Anyway,
wasn't that a problem after Bhopal insurance companies started looking at cutting back?
Yeah, they started playing around with that, and I don't know, maybe enough people said, well, you know, Bob Rowland started an insurance company when he was in the paint industry, maybe he'll start one again. And we started doing that, and we had some special committees and task groups looking at it, and it never really did materialize. Enough companies saw that this was an opportunity as well as a problem, so they got back into it. There was some pooling that went on and some other things. It just never materialized. I looked at it for about a two-year period, and I finally said, look, I wouldn't put the money into doing this. I think there's enough out there that it can handle it. And that's the way it turned out. And today, see what's happened.
Just this past year, Philadelphia, Sun Oil Company, had a refinery down in South Philly, had a catalyst release through a faulty valve. And there was a big yellow cloud. In fact, I saw it out my office window, and we're how many miles away from there. And immediately, one of the Sun representatives was in front of the media saying, well, this is non-toxic. There's nothing to worry about. And yet, it's obvious nobody wants to breathe this stuff, regardless whether it's toxic or not. And I was struck by that because almost immediately the community activist groups hit on that statement right away. And for a day or so, there was a big flap in the media because he really didn't handle the situation in a way that would put people at ease. Or, in other words, if I were the general public, I would say he's not being honest.
Sun was not a member of CMA. I'll make that clear to you. They were a member and got out because they felt that complying with responsible care under their new management was more difficult than they could accept, and that they had a program of their own that they felt was equally good. So they dropped out of CMA. They're back in CMA now, I will tell you that. I'm fairly certain of that.
Okay.
They have management difficulty. And but I will tell you, to comment on that, and I'm not deprecating Sun, it's a fine company. That's a typical mistake that people make. Whenever you get into a crisis situation, the first thing that you do is, number one, accept the responsibility and sympathize or empathize with the public. Yes, we did wrong. We are very sorry we did wrong. We are going to do everything we can to correct this. If anybody is affected by this, we will do everything we can to assist them. You know, and our people are out there now, and the emergency people are there, and we've all been trained, and we're working with them. And if there's anything the community needs, we stand ready to do that. Second, oh, by the way, the material that was released was not a toxic substance, although it may be bothersome and nauseous or something else. Even that degree of inconvenience should not be accommodated, and blah, blah, blah. Here's what we're doing to prevent that from happening. But you got to, you know, it's the... And we had seminars all over the country. And I can't remember the guy's name, but he was and is still one of the reigning experts in this area. And we made this man a millionaire. He was a professor from up at Princeton. Oh, what the hell's his name? Anyway, he put together videotapes for us and training sessions and everything else as part of the Responsible Care Program. And we held these all over the country, local level, everywhere. And he made the point, and rightfully so, said, you must understand that what the public is manifesting is a sense of outrage. Smoking is a decision they can make to do or not do. Owning a handgun is a decision they can make to have or not have. Living under the yellow cloud is not a decision they can make. You did it to them. So they have a sense of rage about this has been done to them. And the first thing you must do if you want to communicate with them is to ameliorate, to deal with that sense of rage that you would do that, you could do that to them. So it needs heavy mea culpas. And I mean genuine mea culpas, not again, this isn't bullshit beating brains. You must be able to demonstrate to the community that indeed you are sorry, and you open the door and show them how you're going to prevent this from happening again, and explain to them carefully how this one happened. Mm-hmm. That you do know how it happened and why it happened. And now that you know, it won't happen again. So that's a totally different system than you said stonewalling, indeed. Trust me. No, thank you, we don't. And it's, you see, that when I said that this is the era of proactivity, you can see the steps that I've taken you through. The steps of saying community awareness and emergency response. We're good in the ER, but we're not good on the CA. Not everybody thinks they can comply with this kind of a public, you know, persona. Well, we'll train you to do it, and here's how you do it. And then how do we get everybody to comply? So we go to responsible care. Well, how do we make sure responsible care is being done? We have an auditing process and an assistance process. So this has taken, you know, from 89, I guess, 85, remember Bhopal? Bhopal was 84.
84.
Yeah, and 89 was ICCA, and responsible care was around 85, I guess. So you're talking 10 years. 10 years. Which in the lifetime of the industry, in the lifetime of a sea change in management techniques and attitudes and everything else, is a relatively short period of time, in my opinion. You know, and the credit for that, yes, fortuity, that CMA was on the right track and the industry knew what had to be done, but the leadership of the industry gets the credit for it. The guys who made the hard decisions within their companies and that said to their staff, we will do this, who said to their shareholders, we will do this, who said to the public, we will be responsible and do this. These were not easy decisions to make. Not easy.
Do you think that the impetus, at least some of the impetus behind this, was the media coverage that didn't exist years ago, but now you're really operating in the public eye?
There's no question. No question. To this degree, you must say that's why freedom of the press and the First Amendment rights are an inherent and critical part of this country's makeup and its success. You want to take a break?
No, I'm fine. Go ahead.
It's like everything else, though. It's a matter of degree. Yes, I think there have been incredible abuses. One of the biggest abuses, most frustrating, let's say, situations to me, has always been the fact that half-assed scientists and technicians, more technicians than scientists, have been given enormous credibility speaking on behalf of environmental organizations, where very qualified scientific minds and voices working in industry companies have been quiet, or working in academe have been quiet. And the reason why is they say, well, that's not my job, or if I stick my head up like a groundhog, the first one that gets up gets it shot off, and that's not what I'm here for. I think that in balance, media now understands that they've been snookered by the Greenpeaces and the NRDCs and the EDFs and the rest of those people spooked into doing things that were not sound science or not practical, not even truthful in many cases, some cases. Scientific community realizes that if they do not speak up, there will be no scientific community. It's the jobs that pay for their education and their research opportunities. It's the businesses who provide the jobs to the students who pay the tuition that give you the right. It's the grants. It's all of the other stuff if industry goes down the tubes, you go down the tubes. There is no unaffected, innocent bystander in this. You're either a player or you're not. And that's always been an argument of mine. You're either a player or you're not. If you're going to be a player, be a good player. Be an honest player. So, in that respect, the media has been a catalyst, a provocateur, whatever you may want to call them, to move industry into these areas. But that's human nature. That's human nature.
Couldn't keep the head in the sand any longer.
Oh, no. And there were, I mean, let's face it. The transition for the major companies from where they were to responsible care is not that great. The biggest problem that they had in DuPont, the biggest problem that they had was that they had to change the name of what they were doing. And they did that. They incidentally did that. They now are a response. Because prior to that, they had all these programs. And not only had them, but marketed them under their trademark to other industry companies. Now, they're still marketing their techniques and their methodology and everything else, but they'll say, this meets the responsible care criteria. And that's a big step for a proud, you know, leadership company like DuPont. But again, and when the... I don't think it was Ed Jefferson. The current guy.
Willard?
Yeah, Ed. Ed Willard made that determination. He made that determination. And that's a tough choice throughout the company. I mean, think about that.
Jesus. We're going to do something that CMA created?
Yeah? No, the industry created. But, yeah, the media had an effect.
Well, that's part of the bringing the industry together, as opposed to when you started in 78, where there was still this secrecy and this device.
Never could have happened back then.
Well, my favorite story is that Herbert Dow's first plant was in the little town of Navarre, Ohio, and a site along the old Erie and Ohio Canal, or one of the canals.
Yeah.
And he built a plant, and he built a big 10-foot-high fence all around it. And he refused to tell anybody in town what he was doing. And he had a small leak at one point, I think of chlorine. And there was a German pharmacist in town who fancied he knew chemistry, and Dow refused to talk to him, and he created such a public furor, they ran him out of town.
Mm.
And he went off, at some, you know, he left Navarre.
Mm.
That's where his first plant was.
I'll be darned.
And today, Navarre is still a very sleepy little town.
Yes, yeah. Could have had a lot, but had a lot more to worry about. No, these things happen, you know, and I guess my experience in life is that there are some people who are prescient. There are some people who are visionary. But even those people have a way of reading the tea leaves or reading the signs and symbols, and somehow it falls together in their mind or their process of thinking different than everybody else's. And they are creative, and there is a creative skill, a creative gene. People who have great inquisition, they wonder why, they're always challenging. But the rest of us, you know, by and large, you know, are just trying to look over the next hill, trying to create and this is one of the big things about industry and industry organizations. Certainty. The hobgoblin of industry is uncertainty. You'll see business will accept any degree, almost, of rule or regulation as long as everybody has to do it and we know when we have to do it and how we're going to have to do it. And, you know, I've preached this to the guys. I said, you know, don't come in here and pound the table and say they can't do that to me, because they can. And if they can, they probably will. And you will comply. You will find a way to comply. So don't let's give me this bullshit that I can't do it. Either come up with a better way to do it so that they don't do it to you this way, or let's figure out how we can do it and let them get on with it. What difference does it make?
They want to raise the price for you? Fine, let them raise the price for you. You can't do it. But if they're going to force you to do it, then they're going to pay the price. And when the consumer says, I'm not going to pay that, boy, you'll see those things be taken out of the cars or taken out of this or taken out of that. And you've seen it happen. So I said, you know, don't say they can't do it. They can do it. But most of the time, what we're trying to do is create a level playing field economically, a degree of certainty that lets us build our businesses, plan our activities, and enough creativity that we are that much ahead, that much ahead. Other than that, you know, if I went off and closed myself in a room and said, I'm going to think about what's the most important thing for the chemical industry in the next decade, you know, by the time I thought of it, they'd have fired me probably.
There'd be nothing out here.
What about instinct? I've had several, I've been amazed at how many people I've talked to who, when it comes to decision-making time, says one of the factors that plays a part is gut instinct.
It's true. It's absolutely true. Gastronomic reaction. What we used to call in law gastronomic jurisprudence. But, you know, instinct is like wisdom. It's an acquired talent, I think. And it's acquired by many experiences over time. And the reason I mention, you know, and I think of it often, the visits to the little dealers in the little neighborhoods with my father and his old Ford, you know, that's all part of that learning process. That's all part of the instinct. And the more experiences you have, the more you learn. And you put that together. Aside from that, there is then a, I think there's a moral quotient involved in this thing too. A strong sense of what's right and what's wrong. Call it moral, call it equity, call it whatever you want to. But I always feel that it's somewhere, and I've preached this around here too. We've had a number of people on our staff, I can think of four, who have come to me and said, Bob, we love working here. A couple of lawyers, a couple of technical people. But we think we're on the wrong side of the issue. And I said, well, how do you mean that? Well, I would just be more comfortable if I was arguing on the other side. I said, well, I can appreciate that. And we've worked with those people to get them located in the right place. We've given them recommendations. We remain friends. One of them is in academics now, and over the period of time, he has mellowed more toward our position than where he thought he had to go to begin with. But we have always talked to our staff around here that you must, at some time in this process, and the earlier on the better, come to the decision of, is it right? Is it correct what you are doing? If it's not, we ought not to be doing it. Illustration of that, we created a communications technique here that I will not describe in detail, except to say that we could sandbag the legislators on the Hill, and we could frame issues on TV programs, congressional district by congressional district, in a way that was absolutely foolproof. Absolutely foolproof. The only problem was, it involved a technique where we would send a camera crew up to the Hill to talk to a congressman. We would go to the congressman who was on the opposition side of our issue. We would also go to a congressman who was on our side and another independent third person who was on our side. And we would take those three interviews, put them together, okay, and send them off to the congressional district of the guy who was on our side, so that the guy who was attacking him could not weaken his position at home. When we did, we'd edit those things so that it would look like, you know, this guy was wrong and all these other people were right, but he was the minority in this debate. We didn't deceive, okay? This was no more, no less than 60 minutes or something like that. The problem was, we were using an outside
film agency to do this. We created the issues, we created the script, we did all that, they go in and they do that. And then the thing would appear. And it was awesome. I mean, we could just nail these bastards big time. And we did a couple of them. You know, and it was kind of fortuitous that it came about. We didn't structure it this way. It came about because we didn't have the facilities here to do it. And we started looking at this. And we were having a management meeting once, and we had both the tapes up. And we ran the tapes. And we sat there and said, you know, this is just frightening. It's so good. And it's so helpful to our side. And somebody around the table said, would it pass the red face test if they found out that this was CMA that was doing it? In other words, is it right? Is it correct what we're doing? And we said, well, suppose we tell them that it's CMA that's doing it. And they said, well, then you're not going to get the same kind of interviews that you're getting as you're getting now. And we looked at it, and we said, it wouldn't pass the red face test, and it's not correct. We can get away with it, but we shouldn't do it. And we stopped it. We stopped it. We only did two. Now, that technique was the company, the film company that was doing this with us, took the concept and went to another industry association, and they did it all the time. Mm-hmm. Continued to do it until they became so, you know, disfavored. And I won't tell you which industry it is, but it's not in the chemical industry. It is an industry that is still the lowest ranked industry in the United States, in fact, in the world. So, yes, things have to be instinctive, but they have to be right. They have to be right.
Well, CMA still has a very massive public relations campaign out there now.
Yeah. It's not massive. It's very small, considering the size of the industry, frankly.
But I'm aware of the ads, and I see them.
Yeah. And incidentally, all of those ads are tied to responsible care, and every one of them is reviewed by this advisory panel of environmentalists and teachers and ethicists and all of those kinds of people. There are no industry people on that panel. They're all scientists and teachers and activists. And they review every one of those things. Mm. It's interesting. It's interesting.
Well, I was, this whole community activity group business, I was struck by an article I found that said that Dow had actually gotten Mary Sinclair into the fold, as it were. And, of course, she was, for years, a thorn in Dow's side. When you start bringing the opposition into your committee, working along with you, it makes quite a difference.
It does. And the guy who is responsible for that is a now director and senior official in the company who was one of the people in the Canadian Chemical Producers Association, president of that association at the time that they created responsible care, and was subsequently shipped down to the United States and became active in CMA, and his name is David Buzzelli.
Oh, I've met him.
And that's David's corporate responsibility now. And he is the guy that, and you can see the structure of the Dow organization and the movement in this area as a result of what Dave Buzzelli did. His career has been tied to the responsible care activities. Now, he was also a good businessman. He ran Dow Canada. But that, again, goes back to my story about sitting at the Greenbrier saying, how can we make people toe the line? And some of the guys saying, well, you know, our people up in Canada are playing around with something, and Canada is us, much to their chagrin. One of these days it will be even more.
Well, CMA was heavily involved in NAFTA. And,
Oh, yeah. And the plain fact of the matter is it was the leadership of the officers of CMA that led to the creation of the International Council. It was my dream. was something I worked on for more than 10 years. The Germans were the ones who resisted it most because they felt that it would diminish their role of leadership in the European Chemical Industry Association, and they were the big dog over there. But they finally realized that they could not handle all of these issues by themselves as a country or as the single largest trade association within the European community. And so they found themselves coming over here and working with us and depending on us to show them how to solve some of their problems over there. And when responsible care, you know, the Greens just started killing them in Germany, and they had to turn to responsible care-like programs in order to resist it. So then they realized that, well, maybe there is something to this. And it was going to happen all around the world, and that's what we're about. We have to look out for the interests of our industry all around the world, and the Germans are the biggest exporters of all. So finally they said, okay, well, let's try this. And once we got organized and started with just a handful, I mean, there was the German, the European Association, the U.S. Association, Canada, Australia, and Japan. Okay? And now we've got all kinds of people who want to get into it. India, for example, wants to get in. And these things trouble me enormously. Mexico wants to get in. Brazil wants to get in. Now, a lot of these people have chemical industries and some rather substantial industries. So what we've done is, through the good offices of Hugo Laver from the European Association and our staff here and others, you're going to have to comply with responsible care to get into the International Association. So we created a training facility, a subgroup within the ICCA to deal with responsible care, and we're helping various countries move into responsible care by sharing with them our experiences and everything in the U.S. and Canada and what have you. And we have a criteria that we've written that says you can't get in until you meet these criteria. You must have at least this much of a program. You must have, you know, this kind of activity going on. So we are using the ICCA as the vehicle for propagating and training responsible care around the world. And these other industry organizations, we will let them come to ICCA meetings, but they only come as a responsible care communicant, not as a vote around the table of the big five. And until we see a movement of the same kind of ethic, the same kind of commitment, the same kind of evolution as we've gone through in our industries, we ain't gonna let them sit at the table.
You spent 20 years with your previous association.
Yes.
It seems like a long time to be in one spot like that.
I just started young, that's all. It was the best job in town next to this one. It was just delightful. And finally, you know, I had reached the point. There were other opportunities that were offered to me, other trade association opportunities, other things that I really can't discuss, prefer not to discuss. One of them that was offered to me, they offered NAM to me right after I came here. Well, I said, no, I'm committed to the chemical industry. I said, but I can get you a guy who can run NAM that would be perfect. And I will tell you that I engineered that job for Sandy Trowbridge, who was one of the best leaders of NAM until he retired and Jerry Jasnowski came in behind him. And because of the leadership of those two guys and some stupid mistakes that the chamber made, I think NAM is more influential today than the chamber is. And there were jobs in industry that were offered to me. And you know, there was just something about, hey, I was very interested in what I was doing, and I was, even though it was a smaller structure, we were doing 7 million or so when I left Pink Coatings. I think they were bigger budget-wise than MCA was, and certainly much more influential. believe it or not, as an association. I mean, you can't say that we were more influential than Dow or DuPont or the individual components, but we were organized. I guess I ran out of interest in, and I saw that there was very little growth after I had been there about 15 years, and I knew I had maxed out, and I had done as much as I possibly could do at that time. I didn't coast. I don't believe in that. I don't think people do. But I also believe that when you're ready to make a move, there is something out there. And it's, I guess, like an intellectual estrus or something, that when it happens and you go into heat, people are aware of that, and then you become a known entity. You don't send your resume around. I never did that. I never wrote a resume. Never have had one out. But it became obvious that I knew what my next job would be. I will tell you in all candor, I knew that MCA would be my next job, should be my next job. And there were people who were active in MCA who said, God, you ought to go do this. And I said, well, it's not my job to apply for it. If you want somebody, you know, let me know. In the meantime, I continue to develop some good things down there. And I will tell you that when the time came, the ability to walk in to an executive committee meeting of the leaders of the chemical industry and read the list of 15 and say, these are the things that we must do and why we must do them. I mean, from that moment on, there was no question in their minds or mine that we were going to run the ship and that I was in charge of it. And they had put me in charge. And I would push them as far as I possibly could. But when they said no, that's no. I understood that.
You mentioned earlier you still have that original
list. Yeah, I do.
List. Would it be possible to get a copy of that somewhere along the line?
I'll go home and pull it out and look at it.
If you feel comfortable with it, it would be interesting to have that on record somewhere.
Yeah, I have it. And I think I know where it is.
Okay. You still got a little bit of time. I don't know what your time frame is. You said noon.
Yeah.
Okay. We had briefly mentioned this earlier when you showed me the medal, but what did it mean to you to win that medal from SCI?
I will tell you in all candor, I am a person who never looked. If you ask me dates and I have trouble reconstructing. I can tell you how I felt. I can tell you what I did. But to say that, well, it was March of 1982, you know, I can't do that. I have never dwelt on the past. I have always been more concerned with the future. But all of us, in our hearts, in our minds, wonder, did we do well? I don't have an ego wall. You know what an ego wall is. I never had one in my office. I don't have one at home. The people who get the credit in CMA are the members and the staff. If it gets screwed up, I get the blame. They get the credit. That's the way it has to be. But you still wonder, did I do well? And it, frankly, until I sat down and read the stuff that was prepared for the submission, I never really realized, well, we did do a lot, didn't we? We have accomplished a lot. And since then, any number of people have come to me and said, I can't tell you how much your guidance meant to me. I can't tell you how much your leadership meant. I can't tell you how much I've learned from you and all of that. And I never, ever did it with that in mind. Mentoring was something that I just assumed was a responsibility that managers had and that good people had. So that after I retired, and my retirement was planned by me, I picked the time, I picked the circumstances, I gave them the list of people from which they could choose my successor. I advised my staff. My successor was in here for the better part of a year. For the last 6 months or 5 months of that, he ran CMA. I sat in the office. His office was down there. I said, but you're going to run it. I'll be here, but you're going to run it, and everybody's going to know you're running it. So that when the day comes in June that I walk out of Greenbrier and you get sworn in, you're going to be able to take out your list of 15 and walk up in front of the executive committee and do the same thing that I did, because you'll know what's going on. Despite all of that, you still wonder, did I do well? And did I do good? And that medal was the highest honor that I could have. It was the greatest, and the dinner. The dinner. And very particularly, to be there with Keith McKinnon, who was one of my peers. Keith and I are age, I'm a little older than Keith is. But we went through so many things together. The Paul Orvis thing, he was Paul's Sherpa. He was our counselor on so many issues. We learned, he is the preeminent crisis control manager in the whole industry. You know, and to get an award at the same dinner with Keith McKinnon, and to have all, and I know a lot of those people were there because of Keith, but a lot of them were there because it was both of us. And to get that award, which has only been given 6 times, and very especially because Keith helped enormously in the international area, and so did Frank Popoff. I mean, Dal was always a major player and a major supporter. And I believed my greatest goal was to eventually create a hemispheric association. Canada, U.S., North America, Central America, South America. I always believed that that was the answer to the common market. I still believe that it's the answer to the common market. And I think they're the markets that we can control, and then we can compete everywhere else, and that's gravy. We know how to do that. But I think this is ours. If we can't capture this hemisphere, I don't know who the hell can. So, getting this medal for something that I spent more personal time on than almost anybody else, that I inveigled the officers into going along with me on, that was a hard sell, that has resulted in some very good things happening for the industry globally, I was very proud of that. And when I left that dinner, and when I was advised that this was happening, and I got some wonderful letters, just wonderful letters, you know, I could really say, Bob, you must have done okay. It must have been rewarding to them. It must have been useful to them. You can feel as though you accomplished something. And I think all of us need that kind of justification. I think all of us need that verification that the things that we've done, and I always slept at night, and I've lived in the empty room, and that's what being a CEO is. You live in the empty room. If you can't live in that empty room, because you have to make the final decisions, you can get all the counsel you need, you can have all the friends you need, but you have to sit in that room and say, do I put it on the line? Do I put them on the line? And this just is a verification that, yeah, you did it better. You batted better than 300, I guess. It's worthwhile. Don't stop doing it. You know, a lot of it is kind of social, but it is very important. I told you to the degree to which the people in industry look forward to these medals. It's a driver. And it is very important to them, and I think it's very important, you know, to the industry that these things are there. It's a motivator.
Is there anything else that you'd like to add at this point that I haven't covered? I think in one way or another we've looked at pretty much what...
let me see. I think we've talked about most of the involvement and advocacy and the personal stuff and the leadership and the cohesion and the, all of that. I think that one other thing about the medal and the fact that I got it, and And I told our staff here, and I mentioned this when I received the award, I think it is a verification of the worthwhileness of CMA and the association function. I don't think that there are other industries or other organizations that stand in quite the stead that we do and the high regard that we do, and I'm proud of that. I think that is, it's sure a reflection on things that I did and that the staff has done, but it's been permitted, it's been supported by the guys from industry. It's their organization, and they know that. But I think that what's happened at CMA is a laboratory of what can happen in other industries if they put their mind to it. And I, you know, I don't give a damn about other people. I just try to do the best that we can. But I think people are trying to emulate what CMA has been. And to get an award like this is, again, saying that, hey, the association is an important part of the industry. And I think that, as I said, I'm particularly pleased that it has an international spin to it, because that's clearly where the future lies for all industry and to our industry in particular. And I think that, you know, we have the finest, a speech that Bernard Brown gave when he got the medal, and he alluded to this glorious, wonderful industry of ours, this most satisfying career. And, you know, to hear people talk about their career, their technology, their life in business, in commerce, as being that gratifying, that has always been an inspiration to me. Aside from the fact that I like working with successful people, these are successful, ethical people. These are people who care about what they're doing. And I will tell you, in the 36 years, and I've worked in the chemical industry all those years, because I considered paint and coatings to be the same, and indeed it is, I can't, on one hand, think of people who I would at least not go across the room to see, or that I would prefer not to see. Finest group of people, bar none. Now, how lucky can you be to work in that kind of environment with those kind of people? And that's what it's been here. Future of chemical innovation, well, it's the freedom to innovate. We've got to fight to keep that. I don't want regulation. I don't want legislation to frustrate innovation at all. And I think that research and development, and not just product development, not just refining, re-engineering, I think we need to continue to do basic research, or close to basic research, and to continue to do innovative things. And there is no industry in the United States other than electronics and chemistry that are doing that today. It's not happening anywhere else.
And even in chemistry, there are times when you wonder, you see things happening that
stuff that should be out there that doesn't get there.
Yes.
Well, I will tell you that we've been working on risk assessment, and we've been working on this product liability stuff for over 10 years in CMA. We were the only association, at least one of the only, a few others, but God, there were precious few of us, and we may get there. And when the language was written, it was our language that was written. When the speaker said, I want to introduce something, I want something done, he came to us. And that's because he knew that we'd been doing it. And we'd been talking with him, and we'd been working in this area for a long time. And I find that to be satisfying.
Well, on that note, I think we'll close, and I'll thank you for spending the morning with me. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Geez, letting the guy run his mouth about himself is hardly hard lifting.